Yeah, and I've seen some of this nonsense in the States where people will say, well, we shouldn't be talking about climate change when we're talking about the survivors and their tragedies. I think that's a cop-out. I think we need to be honest about climate change isn't in the future. It has already happened. And our communities, our response systems, our infrastructure are not prepared for what's happened. You know, we go back to the past and we looked at what we've always done and it used to work. It's not working now. So the most immediate is we have to get past the debate about climate change. As President Obama charged me in 2012 with Superstorm Sandy, the discussion about climate change is over. We got to start talking about how are we going to adapt, and adaptation to these changing hazards basically means whatever we have done in the past is not likely to work in the future. We need to change what we're doing.
How is that discussion rolling out at the moment in the United States in terms of the politicization of emergency management and fire?
Well, we still have, you know, from the Trump administration, in many cases, denying or playing down the impacts, yet the same administration's agencies are putting out the reports about climate impact changes, are dealing with this. One of the code words that gets used a lot to talk about climate change without saying climate change is we need to build more resilient communities, which is, I think, an acknowledgement on both sides of the aisle that the cost of disasters and the impacts are increasing at a rate that's not sustainable. And as I point out to people, when you're dealing with record-setting events, not every decade, but every year, there's something going wrong.
Are voters in the United States pushing back?
Not as much on the climate. They're actually, I think, becoming more aware and are using terms like the climate crisis. They're starting to acknowledge that what is happening is not normal. It is being driven by climate change. And then another thing that we are seeing both here but across the world is the financial markets, the capital investments, the insurance industry are all now paying close attention to these risks. And they're starting to talk about what will be insurable and what's not insurable. We've already seen in California thousands of people being notified that their insurance coverage for wildfires is going away. We're seeing investment firms that are advising their clients that investing in areas that have not taken steps to mitigate the impacts of climate change may not be a safe investment, particularly in the mortgage areas and the government securities areas.
Do you think that business case could be that fillip for change?
Yeah, I think politicians can deny what has happened. But when the financial markets are now addressing this, and in some cases are in the same place a lot of local agencies and state agencies are, they know there's a problem. They just haven't figured out how to measure it yet. I think when the markets are starting to talk about climate risk, you can't deny forever. And so I just see there's too much information. There's too much data out there. There are too many of these events occurring too close together that it's hard to deny it. We still see people trying to, but I think when the financial sector is now addressing this and in many cases coming up with their own stark warnings of what the future looks like, both from the economic impacts but also the ability of local and state and territorial governments to continue to absorb these enormous costs without something giving is pretty telling.
You're listening to Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan, and I'm speaking to Craig Fugate, who's a former administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the United States. There was a time where the United States and Australia could share resources as the seasons were seen to be opposite. Are those days over now?
I don't know if they're absolutely over, but because we're seeing such overlap, there doesn't seem to really be a break in the fire season in California. And as far north as Alaska, the fire seasons are starting much earlier and going much longer. And we're already seeing, if we're not able to share resources between Australia and the United States, we're already seeing this now at the local level, where the wildfire risk were so great in California that their mutual aid system of sending fire departments to help other fire departments when the fires broke out, that started to break down because nobody was willing to free up their resources when the fire danger was so high across a lot of the state at the same time.
Another conversation that's going on is about using large aircraft to fight fire. This week in Australia, it was so windy, some of those aircraft could not get up. Where do you see the role of aircraft?
Yeah, we've dealt with all the aircraft issues in the States. I'm in Florida, and we periodically have, during extreme droughts, we'll have very significant wildfire seasons. The big aircraft work best in the rural areas. They don't work well in the interface area because, quite honestly, when they're dropping water, the amount of water speeds are going can do as much damage as it does extinguishing the fire. We use a lot of helicopters in the United States. I think probably the biggest thing about aircraft is moving from fighting these big campaign fires and putting more emphasis on using aircraft in the attack phase for the incipient fires. I think we have a tendency to wait until the fires reach a certain size before we start mobilizing aircraft. In Florida, we learned after the 1998 wildfire season that that was putting us behind the power curve. So when we started seeing fire danger go up, we started bringing in the resources, including a lot of contract aircraft and a lot of heavy helicopters. And we spent quite a bit of time moving away from fighting the big fires to fighting the small fires quickly to just to keep them from getting big. We had to change that approach. And I think other areas are starting to have a look at that. If you're going to use aircraft, is it better to use them in initial attack on small fires, which historically has not been done, versus the fires now that are so large and so massive that at best, under good conditions, we may be able to do some fire management with the aircraft. But quite honestly, we're seeing fires at a point now where the amount of water you're dropping from an aircraft vaporizes in the fire itself.
I'm kind of interested. Here in Australia, we rely heavily on bush volunteers in the firefighting effort. Does that happen in the United States in the same way?
Well, where I'm from and across the South, yes. Many of the rural parts of the state, the primary firefighting force, both for wildland and structural, are volunteers. But that's another trend we've seen in the States, is increasingly fewer and fewer people volunteering. It's becoming increasingly difficult in many rural parts of the country, even where there's paid departments, to secure enough personnel.
Given the changing nature of bushfires, and as you're describing them, you know, water vaporizing as it comes out of a plane, that's a serious fire. Will that be able to continue using volunteer firefighters in those kind of situations?
Well, I don't think we'll get away from volunteer firefighters, but I think we also have to understand that when you're having fires that are lasting, for weeks at a time, and there doesn't seem to be much break in the fire seasons, and in 1998, an example of the 67 counties, 50 of them had active wildfires all at the same time, and we were bringing in people from as far away as Virginia, Pennsylvania and other states just to fight the fires. We ran out of people, volunteers and the professional wildland firefighters.
As we are in the middle of fierce fires at the moment, there's a lot of finger pointing going on, particularly around backburning and why wasn't more backburning done in the winter season. What is your stand on backburning and how it should be used in the firefighting efforts?
Well, I'm from Florida and we live in an ecology that requires fire to actually support various plant species and animal life. And what we found in Florida is when we did not allow the forest to burn, it made the fires worse. So Florida has one of the most aggressive prescribed burning programs in the world. And it is partly because our ecology is actually built around fires. If we do the fires frequently enough, they tend to be very manageable. They burn very, they don't develop the wildfire characteristics, and they do a lot of fuel reduction. So when we do get into a drought and we see that, We knew that in 1998, where we had control burns prior to those wildfires breaking out, those fires burned much cooler. They were not able to get up in the top of the fuels, the ladder fuels, to get into the crowns. They spread slower because there wasn't as much fuel, and they were much easier to control. But it always goes back to the ecology of the area, what is the most suitable practices. But I think we need to get past what people believe and get to the facts of the science of prescribed burning, where it works, where it doesn't work, what the frequency is going to be based upon the ecology of the area. And I think when we get away from the science is when we get into trouble.
Craig Fugate, the former administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the United States, thanks for talking to Australia Wide today.
It's my pleasure.